Welcome to Consensus or Controversy, a special audio program on breast cancer developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the 2018 ASCO annual meeting in Chicago. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The program focused on cases and questions provided by a panel of five community-based general medical oncologists, and we polled both the audience at the satellite meeting and our distinguished faculty of Drs. Harold Burstein, Angelo DeLeo, Sarah Hurwitz, Mark Robeson, Hope Brugo, and George Sledge. To begin, we focused on treatment of patients with localized HER2-positive disease and the most common question, which was selection of adjuvant therapy in patients receiving neoadjuvant treatment. While both the audience and faculty used trastuzumab and pertuzumab in patients with residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy, there was disagreement about whether to add pertuzumab in patients having a pathologic complete response. Dr. Rugo began the discussion.
Well, of course, we don't have any data on this at all. It's a data-free zone. The AFFINITY trial looked at trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting, and the NeoSphere trial looked at trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting, but was followed by trastuzumab, and the patients also received anthracyclines out back. So I think that the idea behind my response was that I found that when patients receive both trastuzumab and pertuzumab, they have more side effects than if they get trastuzumab alone. And if they have a pathologic complete response and they're doing very, very well, it is likely that they will do just as well with trastuzumab alone to complete 1 year. And I don't think we have enough data to really justify giving the additional antibody for most patients in that setting. On the other hand, if patients have residual disease, they may benefit from continued exposure to antibody therapy. And we've seen that in the studies that looked at short versus long trastuzumab, so 1 year, our standard, versus 6 months or 9 weeks. The patients who had higher risk disease are the ones that seem to benefit from getting the longer duration exposure to trastuzumab. And so it does make sense to me in that situation to give the double antibodies.
So, Mark, I guess we're in the art of oncology here. How come you use both antibodies, even in a patient with a path CR?
Well, my reasoning is that if they got a path CR with both antibodies, then maybe that second antibody contributed to that. And so if that was part of the benefit, as we know from the neoadjuvant trials, then keep going with what's worked. So that was...
Hal?
I agree with Mark. The drugs worked. If you are thinking of pertuzumab as an adjuvant treatment, the only data we have for its use is a year of therapy. And as he alluded to, you know, there's pretty clear evidence that you're on the right track. I mean, arguably, if the tumor is resistant to it with residual disease, it probably makes less sense in some respects to continue it than crossing over, though I would give it there as well.
So a question from the audience, Hope, is the issue of 6 months of adjuvant trastuzumab. Just give us the bottom line in about 20 seconds.
There are a number of different studies looking at 6 versus 12 months or 9 weeks versus 12 months of trastuzumab and 1 year versus 2 years. Longer than 1 year doesn't seem to provide benefit. And in some patients, potentially with lower risk disease, a shorter duration of trastuzumab may provide the same benefit as a longer duration.
So can you envision a clinical situation where you'd recommend 6 months?
You know, it's hard because in the U.S., our standard is 1 year, and we have conflicting studies. And the study that was just presented, although impressive in terms of its non-inferiority, did have patients who were treated in a different way than we treat them standardly in the U.S. and the way they're treated now in the U.K. And the patients were kind of selected to be lower risk so they could get 6 months as well. You know, you could treat your patient and have them be on trastuzumab and then select them to be randomized on the trial. So, you know, it's a little bit of a bias. So I think if I had an older patient or a patient with toxicity or somebody who desperately wanted to stop with lower risk disease, I wouldn't fall on my sword about stopping them at 6 months. And I would feel confident that I had provided them with a reasonable amount of therapy. But for the majority of patients we treat who tend to have somewhat higher risk disease, I would probably still give a year.
And I assume also would mean you wouldn't consider 6 months of pertuzumab and trastuzumab.
You know, it's just so completely non-evidence-based that I don't think we can even go there.
Sarah, last year we saw the AFFINITY trial, and that was also around the time that neratinib was approved as post-adjuvant therapy, so we wanted to see where we are kind of a year later. So we presented this case, a 2.5 centimeter node negative tumor that was ER negative. And it looks like the audience is kind of split about whether or not to use pertuzumab in this situation. When we asked the faculty about this, most people would use pertuzumab, Angelo being the only one who doesn't. So I'll start with Sarah. And also we asked about post-adjuvant neratinib. And as is often the case when we poll people, when we say ER negative, they say no. When we say ER positive, they think about using neratinib. Sarah, what prompts you to include pertuzumab in this node negative situation?
You know, it's a tough call, and I really could have gone either way. And certainly in the clinic setting, I think this would require a balanced discussion. I am compelled by the neoadjuvant data that show at least an improvement in path CR with the two antibodies combined with the chemotherapy regimen. The affinity did seem to show some preferential benefit in the ER-negative subset. If this is a very healthy 65-year-old woman who wants to be aggressive, I think TCHP is a good regimen. If she were to run into febrile neutropenia or diarrhea during treatment with this, which a not insignificant number of patients do, I would pull back on the pertuzumab and drop that first.
So just out of curiosity, Sarah, if this tumor were ER positive, still node negative, would you bring up post-adjuvant neratinib?
I would bring it up and probably would recommend it, but would not use pertuzumab in that situation.
Well, that's interesting. So Angelo, I see you're thinking about, or you would use paclitaxel trastuzumab in this patient, although it is a little bit larger node negative tumor. What's your thinking, and what situations, Angelo, are you using adjuvant pertuzumab?
Well, actually, we tend to use adjuvant pertuzumab mainly in patients with node positive, ER negative disease. This is a patient actually that could have been eligible for the APT trial a few years ago, and we know from the APT trial updated results that these patients are doing quite well with paclitaxel trastuzumab. I'm not saying pertuzumab should not be considered at all. I'm just saying that I tended to use pertuzumab mainly in patients with node-positive disease.
So, George, we also presented some node-positive situations. So we said, in this case, a patient with two positive nodes, ER-negative, HER2-positive, and it looks like the vast majority of the audience is using pertuzumab, and actually a small minority are actually including an anthracycline. We asked also about post-adjuvant neratinib in this situation. So ER negative, but two positive nodes. And actually, a third of the audience would recommend neratinib in this situation. In contrast, our faculty, although uniformly going for pertuzumab with a couple people using an anthracycline, and no neratinib. George, can you comment?
Sure. Well, I think first thing to say is that the neratinib data, while it's positive, and I think truly positive, is in a setting where absolutely no one got pertuzumab. My answer to the neratinib question was posited based on the fact that I gave pertuzumab as the adjuvant treatment. If I had not, then I think it would certainly be reasonable to consider neratinib. But we simply have no data for neratinib in a pertuzumab setting.
So again, we flipped the case and said, okay, same situation, two positive nodes, Mark, but now the tumor's ER positive. And it's hard to think of other situations where ER is affecting choice of therapy, at least in the early stage, with HER2-positive disease. Here we see now 42% of the audience saying they would use, not that many more than with the ER-negative. However, when we asked the faculty, everybody except you said yes. What's your kind of thinking right now, Mark, about neratinib? Are there any situations where you use it?
In the higher-risk situation, we use a lot of pertuz, and as George just said, and I'm not clear that if you use the pertuzumab, you get incremental benefit from the neratinib, and another sort of extended period of time with potential toxicity is challenging for me. So that was why I answered that way.
Hope, here's a real case of a patient one of the docs had, 44-year-old woman with a 5-centimeter tumor, gets 6 cycles of neoadjuvant TCHP. She does well, but she has significant residual disease. We already talked about the issue of pertuzumab in this situation, but the other question is post-adjuvant neratinib in patients who've gotten neoadjuvant therapy, Hope. How do you think that went through? Because I don't know how many of those patients were actually in the ExteNet study.
There were a few percentage of patients who got neoadjuvant therapy, and certainly the approval is for either neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatment, but I think, you know, this patient has ER-negative disease, and although I don't believe that there's a link between who should get neratinib and pertuzumab, I don't make that same link because I think they work very differently and that there are preclinical studies from Kent Osborne and others that suggest that these oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors can in some way overcome some resistance in ER-positive disease that's also HER2-positive. So it makes some, I think, scientific sense, and this is ER-negative disease. Even though the approval is overall, it's really that subset that's so striking, just like I tend to use capecitabine in ER-negative, triple-negative, you know, triple-negative disease and not ER-positive disease. So in this situation, it's complex, and what I, you know, the three positive nodes are really what put her in a higher risk situation, and I think one of the issues for a 44-year-old woman in this situation is whether or not she should receive an anthracycline, and then also we're hoping to see the results of the NSABP trial that looked at trastuzumab emtansine, or TDM1 in that situation as well. And of course, there are a lot of novel HER2 therapies that may be used in this setting also.
So just to clarify though, for example, if this patient were ER positive, would you consider neratinib?
Even yes.
Though it was, so you kind of look at it the same way as adjuvant.
Absolutely. So, and actually most of our patients who've gone on neratinib have gotten neoadjuvant therapy.
So Angelo Hope mentioned the issue of anthracycline. I noticed that you actually use anthracyclines in node positive patients. Can you talk about that and also whether you would consider an anthracycline in this patient?
Yeah, I think I would consider actually the tumor is 5 centimeters. She has a ER negative 5 centimeter tumor. So I think that in such a context, I might consider a sequence of anthracyclines followed by paclitaxel plus trastuzumab or pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting. Yeah.
George, any comments about anthracyclines and HER2 positive disease?
Well, one interesting bit of biology, which is very old now, but HER2 and topo 2 alpha are on the same amplicon about a third of the time. And topo 2 alpha is the preferred target for anthracyclines. So there's a real benefit for giving anthracyclines in about a third of HER2 positive patients. We don't know who those are because we don't routinely test for topo 2 alpha.
So what are the clinical situations right now, George, where you would use an anthracycline in a HER2 positive patient, either in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant situation?
Actually, this is a patient who I think it's probably reasonable to consider it. I mean, here we're dealing with a significant volume of residual disease. This patient is pretty much drug resistant to the four drugs that she has received, I think it's safe to say. So we certainly should be thinking about other drugs, and anthracyclines are certainly among those that we can think of.
What number do you give to your patients, for example, Sarah, in terms of their risk of distant recurrence in general if they have a path CR?
It's generally going to be in the mid-80s, I think, to 90s, but without a path CR, you're talking 25% are going to have a recurrence in the next 3 to 5 years. So that's early data. That's not 10-year data. And that's a pretty high risk for non-path CR. Now, that's including both hormone receptor positive and negative.
Hal?
So the only thing I would just caution the audience on is that the management of residual disease after patients have concluded a standard cassette of therapy is a wonderful parlor game because there's no winners and losers in terms of answers. There are hardly any data for whether more is better or less is better. It's probably an under-resourced opportunity for clinical trials, and there are studies that are trying to build on this, but we really are speculating as to whether additional specific therapy would be helpful. And I always worry because I think a lot of times at our tumor boards, we way overinterpret the extent of response or not in thinking about it. So people should be focusing on the standard things we know are helpful and less focused on trying to decipher the response.
So Mark, maybe you can take this case from the audience. 30-year-old patient, 0.4 centimeter HER2 positive, ER positive tumor. Mother died age 45 of breast cancer. She's a BRCA2 germline carrier. She wants to have children. So any chemo? What about pregnancy? What about adjuvant therapy in general? 0.4 centimeters, I'm assuming it's node negative, Mark.
Yeah, we probably at least would discuss TH with her, and then antiestrogen therapy, probably tamoxifen for 5 years.
So Hal, how about this patient? How low do you go?
4 millimeters is how low we go.
Really?
So that's about the threshold. If you go back to the affinity and neratinib outcomes, it's like 10% risk of recurrence at 5 years, not 30% risk. And I don't know exactly what accounts for that. Some of it's probably downstaging. Some of it's better HER2 testing. Some of it's concurrent chemotrastuzumab-based therapy. But when you're building the model, I wonder if the original estimates for risk conversated. Because in my own experience, I do not see 30% of patients relapsing. And if you look at recent data from the I-SPY 2 trial that Hope knows well, if you looked at the patients who had path CR with anti-HER2-based therapy, the 3 to 4 year recurrence risk was 4% or less. So I think that those original estimates, I think, probably underestimate the benefit of trastuzumab and, or perhaps more accurately, overstate the risk. I will concede we don't have 10-year follow-up for affinity or extinet.
This comes up all the time, Angelo, in terms of tumor boards, is like, when do you treat a node-negative tumor under a sonometer? Any global way you approach this question, Angelo?
I think that's the typical situation in which you have to involve the patient into the decision. You know, below 1 centimeter, my trend is basically to treat, by the way, these patients with weekly paclitaxel plus trastuzumab. But it is true that you are dealing with a patient who have a 3 or 4 millimeters tumor node negative and the patient is not strongly motivated for receiving adjuvant chemotherapy, you may still consider not giving that treatment. My trend is basically for treating these patients, but I want to share my decision with the patient. And if I see a patient in front of me who is not convinced at all to receive adjuvant therapy, then this is a situation in which I can consider not giving any adjuvant therapy.
The next topic was the role of genomic assays in the management of ER-positive, HER2-negative localized disease. At the ASCO plenary session this year, the results of the seminal Phase 3 TAILOR-X study were presented and simultaneously published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The trial evaluated the role of chemotherapy in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative disease and a 21-gene recurrence score of 11 to 25. Dr. Ruga began the discussion.
It was a beautiful summary. For node-negative patients, appropriate for chemotherapy. So, you know, if you have a 78-year-old patient with bad cardiac disease or renal dysfunction, and they have a 1.2 centimeter ER-positive breast cancer, you should not get a score on that patient because you don't want to give them chemotherapy. But if you have a patient who's appropriate for chemotherapy based on the TAILOR-X, if you have a score under 11, of course, we know these patients have an excellent outcome with endocrine therapy alone. The data from TAILOR-X suggested that from 11 to 18, for sure, endocrine therapy alone. And then there is this question about 18 to 25, where there may be, in premenopausal women, some group of patients who have larger tumors, maybe a higher score, where there is some small benefit. If it's a continuous variable, and you get up to like 23 and 24, and you have a 3 centimeter tumor, which they didn't even have in TAILOR-X, and it's high grade, even with a score that's maybe 24, you might be thinking maybe there's some benefit of chemotherapy. So for sure, in over 25, everybody got chemotherapy in TAILOR-X, but it's not the scoring system that was used for the original studies with the 21-gene assay. So chemotherapy is variable. If you had a really small cancer, you might not give chemotherapy, even for a tumor that had a slightly higher score. For premenopausal women, they have this suggestion that in a score from 21 to 25 and women under the age of 50, that maybe there's benefit from chemotherapy. And again, I think this is focusing on the idea of it being a continuous variable and that you have to still keep the clinical pathologic factors into play in your decision making, because if the median tumor size was 1.5 and you saw a patient who has a 5 centimeter high grade tumor who's 44, and the score is 23, are you not going to give that patient chemotherapy? That's really the question, because we don't have the data on that patient, and that's where it comes from.
George, we asked the audience, okay, the baseline case here is a 1.5 centimeters node negative, which, as Hope said, was the median in the trial, and we're saying 21 gene recurrence score of 24, which would have been intermediate, and my reading is like is the new low. And the majority of the audience, well, two-thirds, would just not give chemotherapy. George, agree or disagree?
Entirely agree. I mean, I think that's what TAILOR-X tells us. This was the classic TAILOR-X patient.
Yes.
And this patient got zero benefit from chemotherapy in TAILOR-X.
So then, George, we said, okay, how about 29? So we push it up over the 25 limit. The audience now flips more towards chemotherapy. George, agree or disagree?
I'd say we don't know. We only have the data we have, and the data stops at a recurrence score of 25. I think there's a little bit different way of looking at this, which is, say, imagine you're going from 25 to 29, and ask yourself, how much incremental change and benefit with chemotherapy are you likely to get with a relatively modest increase in the recurrence score?
I mean, we know every situation you have to individualize it, George, but is there a number right now? I mean, if it's 33 or 35 or 40, where you're pretty much going to recommend chemotherapy, what is that number?
Well, it's usually north of 30 for me.
Okay, so again, as you point out, 29.
But you are affected by the clinical pathologic factors.
Sure.
So then we asked the same two situations, so 24, but premenopausal. And the audience now, George, seems more inclined to use chemotherapy. How are you going to approach a patient, or how are you approaching premenopausal patients with this borderline score?
Well, quite fascinatingly, I had a patient who I saw who was a 42-year-old woman who had a recurrent score of 22. And I told her that what the data suggested was that for someone such as herself, there could be up to a 6% benefit in terms of disease-free survival. Now, what happened next was fascinating. She said, so that means I don't need chemotherapy, huh? Okay. So it's still, I think Angelo said this, you know, at the end of the day, we still sit down and talk to our patients.
Sure.
And the patients end up making the decision.
Sarah, any comments on how these data affected the way you're going to manage patients in this situation? We asked the audience also, we pushed it up to 29 in premenopausal, and you can see the audience is really affected by this data set in terms of the difference between premenopausal and postmenopausal. What are you thinking as you sort of mull this around in your head, Sarah, in terms of how you're going to bring it into the clinic?
I think it's effective in that it makes us feel more comfortable to not overtreat. I think that it was unusual in my practice to be surprised by where an Oncotype DX score ended up when we received the report. What to do in that intermediate range was this huge sort of gray zone for us. And now we have an idea of where sort of the cutoff is. What we don't know is, how does ovarian suppression impact the outcomes for these patients? Is it just as good as chemo? And we don't know how use of adjuvant bisphosphonates impacts these data. So we're still going to have to use our brains and look at the clinicopathologic features as well as the patient's willingness or eagerness to use aggressive therapy.
So Hal, what about, you know, thinking more about ovarian suppression rather than chemo in the premenopausal woman in this new intermediate range? You know, it was pointed out that most of the patients in the TAILORx got tamoxifen. They did not get ovarian adjuvant suppression. So the idea that the chemo maybe was having an ovarian effect is very realistic. Do you think it would be reasonable, instead of offering chemo, to offer ovarian suppression, for example? How?
I think it's certainly worth talking about, and for a couple of reasons. One is, when TAILORx was run between 2006 and 10, ovarian suppression was not a standard treatment, and so we don't really know what the impact would be. The other interesting thing is we've already ignored the top-line result of TAILORx and gone zooming straight to the narrow subset of women less than age 50 with a score 20 to 25, and that's obviously really interesting. But there was an excellent talk about the SOFT and TEX trial by Meredith Regan, and what she showed is that, you know, the benefits of ovarian suppression get bigger as you get tumors that are PR negative, that are higher grade, higher proliferative. What kind of tumors are those? They're tumors that have intermediate Oncotype DX scores. And so I suspect that a lot of the benefit that separates this subgroup could be accomplished with ovarian suppression, but I don't know that that's the case. I think in operational terms these days, if you're ordering the Oncotype DX, you are uncertain about whether to give chemo. And in general, if it's more than about 25, you're going to go towards chemotherapy. And if it's less, you're not. If the patient tells you, I'm not going to take chemotherapy for a 6% absolute difference, you don't need to order the test because there's no way that we're going to get there. And so, that's only after the fact we learned. But, you know, I think that that's around where the operational breakpoint is going to end up at the moment. And there's some very interesting data. The NSABP is in the process of going back to B20, culling out the HER2 positive cases and looking now at the inflection point. Those data will be published before too long. And I think they'll, in general, support the idea that the curves begin to diverge around there. That doesn't mean that everybody who's got a score of 27 needs chemo any more than it means nobody with a score of 21 should get chemo. You do have to look at the patient in front of you and integrate all the clinical stuff.
Actually, I remember last year we were trying to sort of integrate the affinity data. It's always fascinating when the data is just, you know, the first couple of days after data comes out, and then what you see is over a few months, you know, people are talking about sifting it through. Maybe a final thought from Hope, again, in general, but how you see these data affecting the way you make decisions.
I think it's actually really comforting to know, as Sarah mentioned, that with these scores, which newly defined intermediate range, that we can feel very comfortable for the average patient with node negative, ER positive disease not giving chemotherapy. That's the most important point to bring back, because in the past, I think intermediate risk, people got nervous, and I saw patients with small tumors getting chemo for scores of 18, which I didn't feel comfortable with. So this actually helps. It's a tremendous study, validates it prospectively. It also makes the important point, which I think Hal made really very nicely, that the size of the tumor, the clinical pathologic factors, and the patient really matter in that discussion. So at the high end of everything, you may choose something a little bit different.
Also, it was interesting, George, looking at the patients with high recurrence scores. Obviously, the low scores, we've already seen that. Very, very, as Hope said, you know, encouraging to see that. But you saw there with the patients with high recurrence score, significant recurrence even with chemo.
Yep.
Did that sort of change your thinking about the kind of chemo that you might be using?
Well, no, I think we already knew that. I think we've known that actually since the original NSCBP trials. By the way, can I just make one editorial comment,
sure,
if I may? First, I want to congratulate all of you guys in the audience.
Absolutely.
This is a glorious moment in the history of our profession. This is a time where a profession ran a 10,000-patient trial whose avowed goal was to decrease their economic benefit. Think about that. And we got 6,000 women to be randomized to toxic chemotherapy or no therapy. That's a huge achievement. And it wasn't me, it was you guys. It was people in the audience who put the patients on the trial. So I think you should give yourself a round of applause, because I think it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, really. Actually, I got those same kind of chills as in 2005 with the adjuvant trastuzumab study. So, you know, you at last minute, we organized that amazing historic education session. Actually, I interviewed George the next morning at 6 o'clock in the morning. He agreed to let me interview him, and 44% of the oncologists in the United States actually heard his interview, which is really amazing. Angela?
I think that for the moment, what we really need to know is to understand how much of the benefit that we see in patients younger than 50 is potentially due to the ovarian function suppression effect played by chemo. And I wonder, and it's really good that we have here the senior author of the Telerix paper, I wonder if it would not be possible to do some exploratory but informative analysis that could potentially help in understanding exactly which could potentially be the effect played by chemotherapy in terms of ovarian function suppression.
Yeah,
I wonder if you are planning to do this type of analysis.
We're thinking about planning to do it. We don't know whether or not we have enough data to do it. It's an interesting question, and obviously, you know, the soft and text data for younger women raises the question.
Exactly.
But I guess a question I would ask everyone in this group is, how many patients with 1.5 centimeter ER-positive tumors who are 44 years old have you given combined endocrine blockade to? Because that's the patient I put on tamoxifen, or have put on tamoxifen.
George, can you just provide an update of your thinking in terms of the use of genomic assays in patients with node-positive tumors? Of course, we're looking forward to the RxPONDER study. I'm not sure how long it's going to be. I assume it's going to be a while before we see those data. What are you doing right now, George?
So let me start off by saying that the ASCO guidelines recommend against the use of the 21-gene assay in lymph node-positive patients. This is one of the rare cases where I significantly disagree with my colleagues on the ASCO guidelines panel. Every single thing that we have learned about the 21-gene assay, up to and including yesterday, confirms what we knew 10 years ago, okay? And the likelihood that the RxPONDER trial is going to give us a hugely different result than what we have from smaller, less definitive trials, I think is very low. So I'm personally quite comfortable doing an Oncotype DX for a patient who's got a couple positive lymph nodes.
So a couple of quick cases before we move on. And Sarah, this is from one of our docs. This is a real patient. I want to ask you what you would be thinking in this situation. 66-year-old woman with a 4 centimeter ER-positive HER2-negative tumor. The patient would like to have lumpectomy, but the size of her breast precludes it, and the surgeon says you got to shrink it down significantly. So most common answer here, Sarah, is to use chemotherapy. Significant number of the audience would also use endocrine therapy, and about a quarter would do something that we've seen in investigators, but maybe 25 to 35%, which is to get a genomic assay. Usually it's the 21 gene recurrence score, and then decide. So Sarah, do you use genomic assays in the neoadjuvant setting?
I usually don't, and the reason is this, and that is, for the majority of us, we have a lot of information about the tumor that you are not presenting here. We know if there's LVI, we know what the Ki-67, or at least what the grade of the tumor is, and the PR status. And if there were features that indicated this was a higher grade tumor where chemo is more likely to actually impact the size of the tumor, then I might be more likely to utilize chemotherapy. But given the information we have, we're in a rural rustic hospital with a pathology that only tells us ER and HER2. Yes, I think Oncotype DX would be beneficial here and kind of giving us an idea what sort of impact biologically chemotherapy would be likely to have in this situation. I wouldn't be enthusiastic to use chemo in an ER/PR positive lower grade tumor here. I don't think we're going to get what she needs to get to lumpectomy.
So does that mean you give hormonal therapy?
I have and will in certain situations if it's lower grade, but the patient has to be very committed to doing a long course, at least 6 months with very close follow-up.
Angelo, in fact, this doc actually did a Oncotype and it was low. Gave letrozole, and took about 6 months, got good tumor response. The patient had breast-conserving surgery. What about the strategy that the doc took in this situation? Any comments, Angelo?
Well, you know, actually, I'm not recommending doing Oncotype DX in the neoadjuvant setting, but okay, if this patient got a very good tumor shrinkage after 6 months of letrozole, it's something that can happen. We see sometimes in clinical practice, I'm not very supportive of neoadjuvant endocrine therapy because actually the data that we have are not strong enough to do this in clinical practice. So basically I would have been more in agreement with colleagues who said that they would start neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Let me say also one more thing. Actually, at least in Europe, additional information that we use to decide about neoadjuvant chemotherapy in a case like this would be PGR and also Ki-67 and grade, because if you have a tumor that is ER positive, HER2 negative, grade 1 or low Ki, probably neoadjuvant chemotherapy would not be recommended in a case like this.
So one final case, this one's for you specifically, George, I guess because of your comments about node positive. A patient has a 3.1 centimeter, ER positive, PR positive, low grade, Ki-67 low, two nodes with micromets. Would you order a genomic assay?
I'd be perfectly comfortable with doing so. Yes.
Actually, it doesn't mention the age. Would it make a difference whether it was a young premenopausal woman?
I think certainly age would make a difference.
We next discuss the management of ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease, and to begin, presented a case of a 65-year-old woman with a 4-centimeter ER-positive, HER2-negative tumor with asymptomatic bone metastases. A majority of the audience and most of the faculty would recommend palbociclib and letrozole, and Dr. Ruga began the discussion.
In this patient, I generally would use a CDK4/6 inhibitor and an aromatase inhibitor. That's been the combination. But we have new data that suggests that you could use fulvestrant in that setting as well. I think the downside of fulvestrant for me, until we know that it's a better option than an AI for a patient like this, is that they have to come in monthly for an injection. And after a while, if people's counts are good, I don't have them come in every month for their blood counts, and they can do it at home. They can't get the fulvestrant at home. So that's one reason why I would use an AI and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. I do have some patients who have a lot of joint pains and problems starting up, you know, coming in. So polymyalgia, rheumatica, things like that. And in that situation, fulvestrant seems to be more tolerable. Very active. There's an ongoing trial looking at fulvestrant versus AI with CDK4/6 inhibitor in the first line setting. That's going to be very helpful for us.
That is really interesting. So Mark, we asked the same situation, but a premenopausal woman, and we kind of saw from the faculty the same answers regardless of premenopausal, which is, you know, suppress the ovaries and treat them as a postmenopausal patient. How do you approach the patient who presents de novo, Mark, with metastatic ER-positive, HER2-negative disease? Do you always use a CDK inhibitor?
Now, pretty much. I mean, I think the data are pretty compelling. The delta is so huge that it it's hard not to do it. I think, you know, there's occasional patients who will be in the relapse situation where I'll actually start out with an antiestrogen alone. You know, somebody who has a really, really long disease-free interval, and then first line, sometimes I'll use an AI or even tamoxifen and OFS. But a situation like this with de novo presentation, definitely would do both of them.
So, Angelo, you answered tamoxifen and ovarian suppression in this patient. Why not a CDK inhibitor?
Well, you know, I think that this is a situation in which I would still feel comfortable with endocrine therapy alone, keeping the CDK4/6 inhibitor for the second line. I guess we have some evidence suggesting that perhaps in this group of patients with asymptomatic bone-only disease, you may still keep your CDK4/6 for the second line. And of course, the problem is that the data that we have are coming from trials where there was no crossover. Ideally, the best would have been to have trials with a crossover so that you can actually measure PFS1 and PFS2 and see what happens overall. Unfortunately, these data are not yet there. So I'm not saying that I'm against the use of CDK4/6 inhibitor up front in a patient like this, but I'm saying that I would feel comfortable in starting with endocrine therapy alone in a situation like this one.
So, Sarah, you know, one of the key issues here in deciding what to do is whether you consider the patient, quote, endocrine resistant. Clearly, somebody who, as we'll get to in a second, who has a relapse while they're on, say, adjuvant endocrine therapy is one thing. But another situation that's not rare is a situation of somebody who's had endocrine therapy and now it's stopped. So we presented that situation to the audience of a patient who got 5 years of an adjuvant AI, then was off for 2 years, and presents off endocrine therapy. And the audience seems to be a little bit split between whether to pair up a CDK inhibitor, palbo, with fulvestrant or letrozole. It's interesting that when we asked you all, a lot of you thought about fulvestrant. I guess the thinking being patient already had 5 years of an AI and still is relapsing, even though it's a couple years later. Sarah, how do you decide what hormonal therapy to use in this situation?
Well, again, we don't have data, and it's the patient sitting before you. What was crossing my mind when reading this question was, has this patient's tumor accumulated an ESR1 mutation during those 5 years? We could do next-gen sequencing, or we could just use fulvestrant, which is agnostic to ESR1 mutations that accumulate during AI therapy for the most part. So that's why I chose that. But certainly, if the patient didn't want to come in for a monthly injection, I think this patient would have been perfectly appropriate for any of the three frontline setting studies with an AI plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So I think both were absolutely appropriate. The other thing that colored my recommendation was the results of the Falcon study looking at fulvestrant versus AI. Now, that was an endocrine therapy naive situation, so this patient wouldn't have qualified for that study. However, fulvestrant's data looks very compelling against an AI in that setting.
So, George, I think maybe the most common situation to see relapse is a patient who's actually on endocrine therapy during the 5 years. You know, we've teased out before whether it occurs after 2 years or 4 years. We presented a situation where someone develops metastatic disease 2 years after starting anastrozole. Most of the audience would logically, of course, use fulvestrant, but would combine it with palbociclib. George, in general, what would be your choice in this situation? You actually chose abemaciclib. How come?
I don't feel strongly about abemaciclib versus palbociclib here. I don't think we have convincing evidence that any of the CDK4/6 inhibitors is superior to any of the others currently.
So, Hope, of course, the most common question that our docs had was, how do you choose which one? How come you choose abemaciclib in this situation?
I was rotating. I'm serious. I mean, the data is really good for all three. The hazard ratios line up. The toxicities are a little bit different. You take it continuously. I do like to, you know, try the different agents, and I don't know that it makes a big difference to a patient. If the patient has a lot of GI issues, I wouldn't choose abemaciclib. If they have low counts and just got radiation to their pelvis, I wouldn't choose palbociclib. So I think that those are kind of the decision points that I'm using in individual patients. And, you know, people seem to be doing fine regardless of what I choose. The one person I put on abemaciclib recently was profoundly neutropenic at 1 month.
Wow, interesting.
So, you know, I don't think you can really, you know, finesse it quite well enough.
So, Hal, your center really has been a leader in looking at CDK inhibitors. How do you sort out outside of a trial setting which one to use? You kind of follow similar type of thinking that Hope just described?
So, I mean, I would echo what you've heard. I think clinically, their outcomes are all remarkably similar. In our own day-to-day practice, we most frequently give palbociclib. Our nurses know how to manage the neutrophil counts that come in on the lab test. We have standardized algorithms for that. And in my own personal experience having used the drugs, I find that the asymptomatic neutropenia is more easily managed from the patient's experience point of view than diarrhea. But, you know, I think the other things you've heard about tailoring the treatment based on patient preferences are quite reasonable.
George?
Just one comment on that, because I think, you know, this again gets back to when you're in the clinic, you're dealing with a patient in front of you. I've had a number of patients who I've started on palbociclib, and they have had problems with neutropenia. They've never got a neutropenic fever, but they've done this stop-start yeah. thing that just drives you nuts after a while.
So somehow those fax reports from the outside lab always come in on Friday afternoons at like 4:30, and the nurse has gone home, or you're on your way out the door, and then you're like, you got to call in the lower dose.
Right.
I'm with you on that.
And so that
I make him get the test on Thursday.
That is the patient I've actually crossed over to abemaciclib.
George, if you're more concerned about a patient, higher volume, visceral disease, again, does that affect your choice?
Not particularly.
So another important question, Angelo, is what's after a CDK inhibitor? We asked the audience a situation of a patient who developed, as we were talking about before, metastatic disease while on adjuvant anastrozole, who then got palbo-letrozole, but responded, but then a year later had disease progression. And it looks like the audience is a little bit split between using fulvestrant everolimus, or exemestane everolimus. When we asked you all, we saw a lot of fulvestrant everolimus. Angelo, you put exemestane everolimus. Can you talk about, in general, how you manage these patients?
Actually, the data that we have, unfortunately, in this particular setting are not really robust. We got data coming from Paloma 1 and Paloma 2 suggesting that basically whatever you use after progression to CDK4/6 inhibitors, you have to expect a median time to progression of about 4 or 5 months. That is not exceptional. I think there is still a lot of room for improvement in this particular area. We saw data presented from Paloma 3 trial suggesting actually there is a very tiny cohort of patients, about 5%, carrying RB mutation at the time of progression to a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Probably these are patients where, in my opinion, it's going to be hard to continue endocrine therapy, because probably these are patients who have now tumors which are quite endocrine resistant. That's my hypothesis, that's my belief. Other than that, actually, the other mutations that have been observed in Paloma 3 in patients progressing on palbociclib do not strongly support one treatment over the other. So I think this is a situation in which the clinical sense is still playing a key role. If you have a patient who is progressing rapidly, I would probably go with chemotherapy. Otherwise, if I have a patient who has been stabilized for a quite long time with the combination of palbociclib and endocrine therapy, I would probably continue with either fulvestrant alone or combination of endocrine therapy plus everolimus.
So one final issue, which is patients with CNS disease. And George, we asked this situation to the audience in general. Do you have any preference for a CDK inhibitor in a patient who has CNS disease? How would you answer that question?
I also chose abemaciclib here, and not because I had run the study, but because abemaciclib actually has pretty good CNS penetration compared to the other two agents.
Our next topic was management of HER2-positive metastatic disease. And to begin, we presented the case of a 78-year-old frail patient with de novo ER-positive, HER2-positive breast cancer and asymptomatic lung metastases. The majority of the audience and faculty would not utilize chemotherapy, choosing instead endocrine treatment in combination with either trastuzumab or trastuzumab and pertuzumab. Dr. Burstein began the discussion.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, Neil Love cases are not the demographic of cancer in the real world. Dennis Slamon showed 30-plus years ago that, you know, the classic phenotype for HER2-positive disease was young women with non-screen-detected cancer. So to have a 78-year-old with a de novo ER-positive, HER2-positive cancer can happen, but it's not that common. Having said that, I mean, the key word is frail, because if they're not frail, then the standard of care is chemotherapy plus trastuzumab plus pertuzumab. We have a survival benefit for that regimen, and you wouldn't want to deviate from that as their initial therapy. We would all give chemo, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, peel off the chemo at some point after a response and introduce endocrine therapy. So the question is, can you dodge the chemo piece? And I think we would all be tempted to, and there are now data that this regimen can be effective with endocrine agents and trastuzumab and pertuzumab. Whether it's as effective as chemotherapy, I think is still an open question, but I assume that what we're being clued to here is that we really have good reason not to give chemo. This is the patient who comes in, her son's pushing her in the wheelchair, and you're not going to want to give her paclitaxel every week or something like that.
This next one, Sarah, was kind of surprising to me. A patient who gets TCHP neoadjuvantly, has residual disease, gets a year of trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and then in the first scenario, 4 months later, develops metastatic disease. Everybody goes with T-DM1. And that didn't surprise me. But what was kind of interesting is how many people go for T-DM1, even if it's 18 months later. I kind of feel like when we've asked this in the past, people are more answering like Mark did, which is, you know, going back to, you know, sort of chemo, trastuzumab, pertuzumab. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think the way that Mark responded is absolutely appropriate, I think. However, my two thinking points were toxicity, and this woman has just gone through chemo and her hair has just grown back, and I'd really like to use an agent that helps preserve her quality of life since she now has incurable disease. The other point is most clinical trials of really exciting agents are requiring that the patient has progressed on T-DM1. So it colors my point of view, actually. I want this patient whose disease is clearly at some point resistant to the chemo, trastuzumab, pertuzumab. I expect she'll progress on that. I'd like to give her T-DM1, give her some quality of life, and make her ready for a clinical trial of tucatinib or DS821 or one of these other agents.
Also, we asked the audience whether or not they've administered a CDK inhibitor to a patient with HER2-positive disease, and a few have, most have not. When we asked you all, a bunch of you have actually done that. You, George, actually haven't done it. Hal, you say you've done it several times.
Well, so as Sarah knows well, when Rich Finn and Dennis Slayman studied the cell lines that were sensitive to CDK4/6 inhibition, it was the ER-positive cells and it was the HER2-positive cell lines. And commercially, the companies all focused on the development of the drugs in the ER-positive space, but there was clear activity in the HER2-overexpressing cells as well. And Shyam Goyal, who's a young investigator in our group, has some lovely animal models where they've shown that CDK4/6 inhibition in combination with anti-HER2 therapy can be effective. So perhaps based on our collective, you know, laboratory experiences at our institutions, we're a little more inclined to try that. I have tried it in sort of smoldering HER2-positive, ER-positive cases. Don't tell the insurance companies about it because you're not supposed to do that. I can't tell you if it's clinically powerful or more particularly whether it'll be better than other anti-HER2 therapies.
So this is an actual case. We broke this one down a little because I think there's a very interesting point, a couple interesting points that come out of this, and hope maybe you can respond to this. So a 56-year-old woman, ER-positive, HER2-positive metastatic disease, gets THP, HP, and letrozole, which one of the issues here is hormonal therapy in this situation, but has disease progression 18 months later. And so in keeping, you know, with what we were talking about before, most of the audience would use T-DM1, but it's interesting, some would use it alone, and some would use it with more hormonal therapy, fulvestrant. Hope, how do you think through this issue and the hormonal therapy in this situation?
Well, I think that we'd all agree in the absence of a lot of data that hormone therapy as part of the maintenance with monoclonal antibodies is a good idea for people with HER2-positive, ER-positive disease. And in fact, the study that's in our Alliance Foundation that's looking at CDK inhibitors in this sort of situation assumes that everybody gets hormone therapy and then is randomized to the CDK inhibitor or not. So that's definitely become a sort of standard practice. I think once I go past that monoclonal antibody maintenance, I tend not to use the endocrine therapy with a drug like T-DM1 because we don't really have the data that it's adding there, and I feel like I'm using up something I might use later in maintenance when I'm back on trastuzumab. And really, that's the specific reason why. This patient has progression in liver. Liver disease in this situation tends to be a little less endocrine sensitive and it doesn't work quite as long. You certainly could, but I tend to use T-DM1 alone in this situation. You could actually, in this patient, go back to the taxane again. We don't know what would happen if you gave a little more chemotherapy and continued the HP and an alternate endocrine therapy, but we would all, I think, generally tend to switch to T-DM1.
So actually what happened in this case, in the second part, which is very interesting, is the patient got T-DM1 alone without hormonal therapy, but after 12 months developed brain mets and required whole brain radiation. However, the extracranial disease was stable, and the question is, what's next? So some of the audience would actually, maybe almost half, would keep the T-DM going. Some would add in hormonal therapy at that point. A fair number would switch to either lapatinib capecitabine or the exciting combination of neratinib and capecitabine. Hope, this is sort of a classic situation of a patient progressing in the brain but not elsewhere. What do you do about the systemic therapy?
Well, you know, this is a difficult situation because eventually the patient will be a candidate for trial therapy, as Sarah was talking about, with a number of agents like tucatinib that we might want to use in this situation. But most of the studies require that you have measurable disease elsewhere. And of course, this patient doesn't have any disease that's active outside of the brain. So if they were eligible for a study, say where you get randomized to tucatinib or not with capecitabine, I would consider that if that was an eligibility. But otherwise, in this patient, I would generally continue the systemic therapy and only change with the next progression. You know, you're doing a whole field radiation here, so you're doing whole brain, so you're not worried the same as you are with SRS that you're going to keep popping up with additional small lesions.
And actually, the patient was continuing T-DM1, I think is now about 14 months later, doing well on the T-DM1, so very interesting scenario there. We also got a lot of questions from our docs about neratinib. You know, you hear about that, for example, with HER2 mutations, where you see that with lung cancer, for example. What about neratinib and just metastatic breast cancer systemically?
Well, you know, now it's approved as the extended adjuvant therapy, so it is possible to get compassionate use neratinib in the United States for patients who have refractory HER2-positive disease. But this is a drug which is tough in patients who are very beat up with multiple lines of prior therapy, and diarrhea can really be a big issue even when you're using prophylaxis because people don't want to be constipated. Neratinib is going to come out with a voucher for cholestipol, which is very well tolerated, seems to control the diarrhea very well in the extended adjuvant setting. What it does for patients in the metastatic setting, I don't know. And we will see results from the NALA trial at some point, which compared neratinib to lapatinib, both combined with capecitabine. So that will help us a lot in terms of being able to understand how best to use it.
Sarah, any comments about neratinib and your experience and also cholestipol? I'm not sure I've heard about that with neratinib specifically.
Yeah, so the control study we presented at San Antonio, the interim results, which was a study to look at whether we could control the diarrhea rates with neratinib in the adjuvant setting in particular. And there were several cohorts. One was a cohort of just using plain old antidiarrheal Imodium. And then another cohort was cholestipol, and another one was oral budesonide, which is a steroid that has just GI activity. It's not absorbed systemically. And the rates of grade 3-4 diarrhea went down to 11% in the cholestipol cohort, which is a big reduction. So this may be something that we should be doing clinically. Of course, more data is being collected. That's my biggest reticence in using this agent sort of systematically for my patients, is the diarrhea is substantial.
So, George, what about HER3? I haven't heard about that before.
So, preclinical data from Harvard, from Rakesh Jain's lab there. If you treat a HER2-positive tumor with a HER2-targeting agent, one of the things that happens specifically in the brain is you get huge upregulation of HER3. And in preclinical models, if you now target the HER3 and continue HER2-targeted therapy, you get, if you're a mouse, therapeutic benefit. And so this raises the question of whether or not this something similar is going to occur in humans and whether or not co-targeting of HER2 and HER3 for brain mets might be a reasonable approach.
The next topic was the role of BRCA germline mutation testing and the use of PARP inhibitors in breast cancer, specifically olaparib, in patients with metastatic disease in a BRCA germline mutation. Dr. Hurwitz commented on her approach.
So for a woman with triple-negative breast cancer, we run through our therapies pretty quickly, and the progression-free survival is fairly short with single-agent sequential chemotherapy, which is a standard of care. We know from the data that PARP inhibitors are better tolerated and yield a three-month or more progression-free survival. It's a targeted therapy delivered orally. I'd really like to give this patient a chance at it. On the other hand, for HER2-positive or ER-positive HER2-negative, we have a number of targeted therapies that are well-tolerated available to this patient. I wouldn't, at this point, be doing BRCA testing if she's not Ashkenazi Jewish and absolutely no family history. Although I think in the future, we're going to be doing more and more studies. We're going to be doing cell-free tumor DNA and running genetic tests on pretty much everyone. It's just as of today and what we're doing and keeping in mind insurance coverage, I wouldn't do it upfront in anyone but a triple negative who's 65.
Using multiplex testing such as NGS in general when you run out of options. You can also get data from that kind of assay that relates to this question. You know, even in germline patients, you're going to see those changes in the tumor. And we ask you all are saying if you see either somatic BRCA mutations or PALB2 germline mutations, you're going to consider a PARP inhibitor. Any comments, George, and also this issue of do you do germline testing or you do somatic like NGS and then reflex germline if the family wants to know?
Yeah, I said no here, but it was a very iffy no based on the fact that I didn't feel like I had enough data to know for sure. I actually have done it for a patient with a PALB2 germline mutation. Let me say just something about BRCA testing. You know, the price of not just BRCA1 and 2 testing, but of all germline testing for cancer mutations is falling like a rock. And, you know, 2, 3, 4 years from now, it's going to be the price of a CBC in most hospitals. I suspect that we are rapidly approaching a period as a result of sort of technologic imperialism where every cancer patient is going to have panel testing the moment their cancer is diagnosed. I think 5 years from now, that's a reasonable likelihood. Now, we don't have enough genetics counselors on the planet to tell us what to do with all of this data, but I suspect we're going to have it, and I suspect it's going to be ubiquitous. And so whatever answer I gave you tonight, I suspect I'm going to be doing something different next year.
Well, at least you're honest about it, but that's the way it is in oncology nowadays. So let's try to run through some clinical scenarios. Hope, just to sort of separate out the issue of triple negative and ER positive, HER2 negative. So we said, first of all, you have a patient who has a BRCA germline mutation with triple negative disease presenting de novo. So actually, you see platinum-containing chemo. That makes a lot of sense. You see olaparib. I'm curious, Hope, what you think about that option. But you also see sort of the ovarian model that, you know, maybe general oncologists are used to, but I don't really think has been tested with breast cancer, which is chemo followed by maintenance olaparib. Actually, some people say chemotherapy combined with olaparib. So Hope, can you kind of dissect out the way you think this through?
Well, I would definitely say that chemotherapy combined with olaparib is the wrong choice because olaparib at the standard dose that we use with chemotherapy causes too much bone marrow suppression. Then you see these people whose platelets just never recover. So you don't want to do that. But I think in a patient like this who has de novo disease, comes in with metastatic triple negative disease, they usually have a fair disease burden when they come in the door. So I think most of us would start with a chemotherapy-based regimen. I actually think that it's a very appealing idea to consider a PARP inhibitor. I'm interested in what thinks about it, you know, just in the whole concept of thinking about ovarian cancer, that you could use olaparib as, or whatever approved PARP inhibitor we have as a maintenance after an induction chemotherapy, because, you know, these people, they get so tired of being on chemotherapy, it's very appealing to think of something as maintenance approach. So I like that approach. I probably wouldn't use olaparib alone up front in a patient who'd never seen chemotherapy before and presented with sort of, you know, locally advanced and metastatic triple negative disease.
So Mark, I was really curious to see, you were the only person on the panel who said olaparib up front.
So it's not the indication, right? The indication is after anthracyclines and taxanes, but there's kind of reason to think that prior chemotherapy exposure is going to promote resistance to these types of therapies by selecting for HR proficiency. And it's kind of circumstantial reasoning down a number of different lines. And I mean, there's no a priori reason in my mind why having had an anthracycline and a taxane beforehand would make you more likely to respond to olaparib than it was in the trial setting.
Okay.
So given the fact that I think all of us who've used the drugs have seen pretty significant responses and the time to response is pretty much the same, et cetera, I don't have any problem using it in a de novo setting.
Let's dissect out the issue in terms of ER-positive HER2-negative metastatic disease in the patient with a BRCA germline mutation. So can you talk a little bit, Angelo, you were going to start out with traditional same therapy you'd use if the patient didn't have a germline mutation. When would you be thinking, again, regulatory issues aside, about where a PARP inhibitor would fit in ER-positive HER2-negative metastatic disease?
Well, actually, we do not have comparative data between a PARP inhibitor or the CDK4/6 inhibitor plus endocrine therapy approach in patients with BRCA mutation. But basically, I would tend to start my, let's say, standard endocrine therapy plus or minus targeted therapy, and I would keep the PARP inhibitor for the second, third line of treatment once the patient becomes endocrine resistant. That's what I would do, at least for a question of side effects, because the combination of endocrine therapy plus CDK seems to be better tolerated than a PARP inhibitor in this particular setting.
So, Hope, I was very interested in your response of olaparib plus endocrine therapy.
I know, I was like, I'm an outlier in that. I already know that. But, I actually have a patient like this, and I did treat her with olaparib and endocrine therapy. She had hip fracture when she presented with widespread metastatic disease. She wouldn't take her adjuvant endocrine therapy for a T1C tumor. And, she's actually done phenomenally well on this therapy. She doesn't have her blood counts checked every month. She doesn't have the fatigue that we often see with CDK4/6 inhibitors. And I know that, as Mark was mentioning, patients develop resistance to olaparib sort of along the course of the way so that they don't respond for as long. And I have the feeling, which is not well-founded yet, that if you give it earlier, you may see a longer time to development of resistance. So my thought is that I can give the CDK4/6 inhibitor a second line. We all believe that it's great as second line. Angelo thought we should many times give it in second line. So why not give the olaparib first line, which is reasonably well-tolerated?
So, Mark?
I just wanted to comment that that's a very rational way of approaching things, but combination with a CDK4/6 inhibitor up front is probably not going to happen. I mean, just because
don't do that.
we're gonna do a study to see if we can get that in, but because of cumulative myelosuppression, that's probably not going to be well tolerated.
So, George, we want to show you a case, and get more into the issue of, again, ER-positive, HER2-negative. We've heard a lot from investigators about maybe after first-line endocrine therapy, for example, in this case, the patient who was premenopausal got ovarian suppression, palbociclib, 27-year-old woman, BRCA2 germline mutation. So she gets, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, she has metastatic disease, first-line therapy, she gets ovarian suppression, palbociclib. 14 months later, she has pulmonary lymphangitic carcinomatosis. What would you be thinking about at this point, George?
Well, first, I would probably regret not having done ovarian suppression a couple years earlier. But I think beyond that, is this a case where you'd think about using a PARP inhibitor? I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to do for someone like this. Lymphangitic carcinomatosis, on the other hand, is something where you can get in trouble in a hurry. This is the patient I am more likely to be relatively aggressive with from a chemotherapeutic standpoint.
And Sarah, I noticed you were one of the few people who gave that sort of ovarian answer for one of the cases of platinum and then PARP maintenance. Is this the kind of situation where you might be thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I chose that is if you start with a platinum therapy and the patient progresses on platinum therapy, now we don't have data supporting the use of a PARP inhibitor because none of the studies allowed patients, meaning none, Olympiad and Embraca, who had progressed on platinum-based therapy. And if you follow the ovarian cancer data, platinum resistance sort of predicts for resistance to PARP inhibition. So I'd prefer to get a response. I think pulmonary lymphangitic carcinomatosis is a very poor prognostic indicator, and I'd want to be more aggressive and then do a maintenance strategy.
The final topic was the emerging role of immune checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer, and about 30% of the audience and 4 of the faculty have already administered a checkpoint inhibitor to a patient with metastatic disease outside a clinical trial setting, including Dr. Sledge.
There was an oddball case. It was a patient who we got our in-house genomic assay on. The patient was MSI high.
Ah.
And the patient was 6 weeks from dead with multiple pulmonary metastasis, put her on pembrolizumab, and that was 2 years ago, and she comes in to complain about her lymphedema every month.
Wow. So are you looking for MSI specifically or through NGS in general, George, for breast cancer?
I must say, again, due to the falling prices of this, due to the ubiquity of this, due to the fact that Medicare now says that they will pay for genomic testing on everyone with metastatic disease, regardless of cancer type, I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to do.
So we asked the audience also, what about PD-L1 expression in breast cancer and also tumor mutation burden? Again, that came out with lung cancer. Now it looks like maybe there are going to be some people with low PD-L1, high mutation burden, small cell patients who are going to need the combination of CTLA-4 and PD-1. So actually, it looks like, Hope, the audience is looking at both of these. Do you?
We don't look at PD-L1 expression or actually tumor mutational burden in making any decisions about that. And in mostly cancer patients, you know, our breast cancer patients don't have those features. And we don't even have a standard test for checking for PD-L1 in breast cancer. So
Sarah, it looks like you look for tumor mutation burden. It really is a fascinating story, tumor mutation burden. Has it helped you at all in terms of, you know, even pushing people towards trials?
Yeah, you know, that's what I was thinking of, actually. And I should have been consistent and said yes to both just for trial eligibility. Both are reported on most NGS reports. You will get PD-L1 expression. As Hope said, there's no standardization really for either of these. So interpreting across trials and understanding how to use these is markedly immature in breast cancer right now. So probably the right answer should be no for both right now, although I think it is evolving. And if I saw TMB high or PD-L1 expression, I would certainly refer them for a trial.
So we were kind of curious whether the audience is using next-gen sequencing when they run out of options, and most of them are. That's no big surprise. We've been hearing that for a while. Certainly, again, very understandable. And looks like, in general, the faculty is doing it. I guess, Angela, you're not persuaded that it's really going to be helpful.
I mean, it's a very nice report with a lot of mutations, and you can do a lot of speculations, but with the feet to the ground, let's say that there is no strong evidence that this test may help the clinician in taking decisions for clinical practice, because I'm not aware of any of these mutations that has clearly shown predictive value in patients with metastatic disease.
So this is a case from one of the docs, Hope, and I'm not going to go through all the details. This patient, though, had a history of ulcerative colitis in the past and was still getting prednisone. What about the idea of giving a checkpoint inhibitor to a patient like this, Hope, particularly with breast cancer?
Actually, somebody emailed me and asked me a question like this not so long ago. It was of the Crohn's disease. And so we looked up the literature, and there is actually some literature on this where people have been treated with checkpoint inhibitors while on some sort of immunosuppressive therapy for colitis, as long as the colitis is completely stable and asymptomatic, and have done very, very well. So apparently it doesn't predict that. I think you'd have to be extremely careful in that situation. And this is what I advised the particular physician I was talking to, but I think that, you know, these patients have metastatic disease. So there's two parts to it. One is that you'd love to give them a treatment that worked and help them to live longer, but you don't want to make them miserable in that case. So I think you just have to be very cautious.
There's pretty good data that prior autoimmune disease is not uncommon to see it get flared up giving a checkpoint inhibitor. You get into issues also, people have had organ transplants, what you do about that.
But the data in melanoma, there are some case reports of patients who were on immunosuppressive therapy and then got the checkpoint inhibitor and did okay.
Oh yeah, some of them do fine, yeah. But you do see a flaring of many cases. Yeah. George?
Yeah, so I'll mention the NCI has just put together, is in the process of putting together a consortium of institutions that are specifically going to be looking at checkpoint inhibitor therapy in patients with connective tissue disease, where that'll actually be the enrollment.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and to our community oncology panel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio program based on a satellite CME symposium at the 2018 ASCO meeting.